Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of My Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Robert. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Doing very well. Today on the show, we have Amy Bensonhaver, who is an open records expert. She was very clear. She wanted to say that she was an open records expert and not the open records expert.
But she's one of the top.
Yeah, we understand what she's saying, but we hold her in very high esteem when it comes to open records and open meetings. It was a very good discussion. We talked a little bit, since it's Sunshine Week, about the importance of open records and open meetings, open government generally, who are the champions in Kentucky, who have been the champions over the years, and kind of the state of open records and open meetings in Kentucky. So that's a good conversation. We hope you listen to it. But before that, we have lots of other topics. Jasmine's going to talk about medical marijuana and kind of a landmark vote that got taken in the House this year. I'm going to talk to us a little bit about passports. It's a little bit of an old segment, but it's still important. And we're going to talk about the teacher sickouts, which have been ongoing for a couple weeks now. And of course, we have tons of stuff to catch up on in Quick Hits. The first thing I wanted to talk about, though, is that you might have noticed that I was not here on the podcast last week. And we also didn't send out a newsletter. It's been a tough week for me. So my wife, Kelsey, and I, we were in fertility treatments for almost all of 2018, and she managed to get pregnant around Thanksgiving. We had our 20-week ultrasound last Wednesday, and it did not go well. So our baby, who we named Willa, she had a type of encephaly, and that basically means that her brain did not develop. So that also meant that her spine didn't develop, and that caused major problems with her limbs, and there were other issues too, but the doctors kind of quit telling us because we were really clearly very upset about what was going on. So we were told that the baby was likely to die in the womb, and that if she survived the delivery, she would probably only survive hours or a day maybe, and would never leave the hospital. It was really difficult, but we made the decision to terminate the pregnancy. So that was actually a very easy decision to make, like, on the merits. This baby clearly was not going to live very long, and that, you know, she was almost certainly going to die, and her existence in Kelsey's womb put Kelsey at risk. But actually saying the words of "we're going to terminate this pregnancy" was very, very difficult. So, you know, this is huge for us personally, but it actually weirdly and kind of horribly intersects with state government. You might remember that last Wednesday, the day that we were at the ultrasound and got this news, was also the day of Kentucky's annual Rally for Life.
Right.
Yeah. So Governor Bevin and many others were at the Capitol expressing their opposition to abortion rights, and many of the abortion bills were slated for final passage, like, there on Wednesday. And at least one in probably three of the bills that we've talked about on the show and that are before the legislature right now would have prevented my wife from the care that she needed to terminate her pregnancy. Senate Bill 9, the fetal heartbeat bill, definitely would have prevented her from termination. It doesn't have any measures about protection of the mother's life or about fetal anomalies.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the craziest things about this, given, you know, the existence of this podcast and the person that I am just kind of in public, is that we were, like, incredibly fearful that this bill would pass the Kentucky House and be signed by the governor on Thursday. And in Kentucky and in other states, there's a 24-hour waiting period before an abortion can be performed. And that actually put our access to the care in the hands of the Kentucky House of Representatives and Governor Bevin.
I can't imagine.
Right.
Leaving.
Yeah.
Such important decisions in the legislature's hands.
Right.
And Governor Bevin's.
Yeah. I mean, and it's just like we were living in fear that this was going to pass and he was going to sign it into law as, like, a show of force. And then we were basically going to be left without any options. But luckily that didn't happen. Those bills are still not passed as of today, even though they were likely to pass at the end of last week. So we ended up having the procedure at EMW Women's Center downtown in Louisville on Friday and Saturday. It's a 2-day process when you're 20 weeks. And it was incredibly difficult. We had to dodge protesters that were calling us baby killers and calling us murderers, and even some that, like, actually offered to adopt our baby. And for some reason, for me, that was especially poignant and difficult because we so desperately wanted
right.
this baby. You know, we've mm-hmm. been in fertility treatments for so long. We were so happy when we got pregnant. And then to hear somebody say, "If you don't want your baby, I'll adopt it," when that's, like, so opposite of what the reality is, it was very hard to hear.
And I think that's the reality for probably a lot of people there.
Absolutely.
As well.
No, yeah, absolutely. Once we made it inside the clinic, the staff at EMW was actually just incredibly compassionate and kind. The physician that performed the abortion even, like, actually called local funeral homes to make sure that we could have the remains cremated. And she made sure that we could preserve some of our daughter's genetic material for studies so that we could further investigate what caused this anomaly so that we could try to prevent it the next time we had a child. And that just runs so counter to what people would say about abortion doctors generally as these like kind of cold or uncaring mm-hmm. people that kill babies. Like she very clearly was like a part of this journey for us and was working very hard to make sure that our needs were met, both in a medical and just an emotional sense.
And not only that, are the doctors just super caring, the clinic escorts.
Oh my gosh. I can't even describe to you, Jasmine. Another thing that was incredibly difficult in the midst of all this is, we're in the season of Lent, the Christian season of Lent. And of course, Catholics are very, anti-abortion as a mm-hmm. whole. And there were like 150 protesters in front of the clinic on Saturday morning when Kelsey finished her surgery. And, we had to dodge all those people. And without those escorts, I don't know how we would have made it inside, to be honest with you, with all of the people that were around there. So, this incredible work by those clinic escorts just to help Kelsey and make sure that she could get this procedure. And, abortion is a very hot topic in Kentucky and across the country right now. There's a lot of misinformation about abortions that happen later in pregnancy like ours, with some even using the language of like infanticide. I saw that Governor Bevin said that in an op-ed that was released just a couple of days ago. But abortions later in pregnancy are almost always people in similar circumstances to us. And trust me when I say that this was absolutely not an easy decision. It was very difficult, even with the information that this baby was not going to live. When you hear about these kind of bans going into place, preventing second and third trimester abortions, the people that are actually going to be impacted by these bans are people like me and my wife, Kelsey. So I'm really sorry I missed last week. If, Jasmine, I know I put you kind of in a tough spot, and I know that, we try to put out a show every week and we were successful. But I do know that everybody's going to understand. It's been a really, really difficult week for Kelsey and me. And if you're a person who prays, we ask that you pray for us.
And, listeners may not know, Robert's not just my podcast co-host. He's one of my very best friends and has been for 10 years. And so, I certainly understand, and I'm happy to do the podcast when things like this come up. And I also just want to say that I think it's very brave of you to put your story out there. You've kind of blown up on Twitter, and I know that you're going through something really difficult. And while it seems like people have been very largely supportive on the internet, but there have been some terrible people that have been really mean to you, and I'm sure that's really hard to do with. So I think it's very brave for you to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And how it intersects with politics and state government. So yeah.
I'm a pretty public person, as is evidenced by the fact that like we came up with the idea to do a podcast and put it out into the world. My wife's a much more private person. I would love to get her on here at some point to talk through some of this. She's been very supportive of sharing the story, but it's a little different for her. She does want the story to be told. And she does think it's really important that people who have to go through this, they have somebody that they can point to as somebody, this is my story. This is similar to my story. I do hope to be able to talk to her and have you guys hear her share the story, because at the end of the day, abortion is at its core a woman's issue. I think, mm-hmm. I mean, Kelsey's the one that had to have surgery. Kelsey's the one that had to, feel the baby kick when she knew that it didn't have a brain. And so on that level, that's something just on a visceral level that I'll never be able to understand, and only she can communicate to you. So that's one of the reasons I would love for her to share. But that's not going to happen yet. She's not totally comfortable sharing yet. It has been just incredibly difficult. So continue to think of us in this time. So, and it's super weird that it intersects with state government. So you go. Well, that's that. But we have lots of other stuff that we want to talk about, and we're going to continue to soldier on. So, Jasmine, I want to talk a little bit about the teacher sick out. You talked about this last week. This was the show that we wanted to talk about was these sick outs that were happening, teachers protesting bills that were going on. And Jasmine, you talked last week about the bills that were causing teachers to have concerns. And the sick outs have actually continued. In Louisville, kids have missed five days out of school in 2 weeks due to the legislative session, and other districts have seen some sick outs, but JCPS has really been
right.
Kind of the,
I think Bullitt and Oldham have been closed for, one or two days of this, but this is really JCPS taking this on.
Right. And those, of course, are counties that border Louisville. So that's a good way to point that out. So Jasmine, you know, you did a very good job of explaining some of the key legislation that the teachers are really worried about. But I think it's really important that we point out that this is about more than just bills that we know about. Teachers seem to be equally concerned, or maybe even more concerned, about legislation that has yet to be introduced or announced.
Right. And so I talked about this a little bit last week, that it's more than just, you know, these five or six bills that they oppose. It's more about what Frankfurt is trying to do to public education.
Right.
And we've seen before things get slipped in at the last minute. And
right.
So I think that's why there's been this big push here at the end.
Absolutely.
Right?
And I mean, that's exactly what happened last year. Just like you said, like we had that, it was a sewage bill and then it became a teacher pensions bill. So the legislative leaders seem to be slipping in things to the last second over the last couple of sessions. And, you know, of course the teachers are anxious about this. Who wouldn't be? So last Thursday, there was actually a rumor started that the legislature was going to try to sneak in a special session on Friday in order to pass a couple of education bills quickly. So that started spreading, even though such a thing really isn't all that possible. It takes five legislative days to pass any legislation. And in the midst of this, like while this rumor is swirling around and people are like looking for answers and not knowing who to trust, when people are like, no, that's not a real thing, you can't actually do that, Rocky Adkins, Democratic leader in the House, stood in the middle of the rotunda with many of the protesters and they peppered him with questions about legislative procedures and he just sat there and answered
right.
all of them.
This was kind of crazy.
Yeah.
It was just like a Rocky Adkins Q&A.
Yeah.
That just...
Which not even about
happens
his campaign.
Spontaneously.
Yeah, not about the campaign, not about like major issues, but like how does the legislative process work?
How does a bill become law?
Yeah, which is pretty neat. Morgan McGarvey, the Senate leader for the Democrats, also posted a video that went over the legislative process. I think last time I saw it this morning, it had about 70,000 views. So
mm-hmm.
that obviously is something that helped as well. So people are very distrustful, you know, they're not knowing who the source of truth is. When people tell them that a special session like this is impossible, it takes, you know, no one less than the Democratic leader in the House to be able to like calm the situation down. So JCTA, which is the teachers union in Louisville, they actually tried to strike a deal with JCPS to avoid more closed days. The union tried to like spread out the number of teachers calling in sick across more schools. So like to only have, I think the plan was to have like three people at each school call in sick each day to prevent school overall from closing. But obviously that
deal
failed.
And I think other counties have been successful at this. And that's why you're not seeing closing statewide. I think smaller counties have agreements where they have representatives in Frankfurt to make sure someone's there. But Jefferson County, I think maybe it's just too big to,
well,
to stop everybody. I don't know.
Another one of the things is that I think that since this fight started last year, there's some serious discomfort between JCPS teachers and the JCTA union.
Yeah, that too.
He obviously has a tough job because they can't call for strikes. They can't call for sick outs. That's like literally against the law. And if they do, they'll get in trouble. So he's got in this like unenviable position of being like, I can't say do this. And people interpret that as saying, maybe don't do this. And then, of course, there's additional things that make some people uncomfortable with them. And even like one day, GCTA announced on Facebook last week that they said they did not recommend this action and that they are concerned that continued disruptions of this nature undermine community support for educators and public education, which didn't go over very
well. Yeah, it wasn't. Well received.
Yeah, that
lots
was,
of comments on
was
Facebook.
A, yeah, that Facebook post I think had many more like frowny faces, the red frowny face, than they had like
ratioed
thumbs up, whatever the Facebook version of ratioed is. And last year, you know, this is kind of ongoing, and I think like last year, teachers kind of passed over the union and set up this like the Kentucky 120 United. We've talked about them before. That's kind of an organization they set up because they were kind of frustrated with the actions of the union. That's how some people choose to interpret that. Whether or not that's true, that's up for interpretation. But even this week, Black Lives Matter Louisville expressed support for a new organization called JCPS Leads after saying, quote, the leadership under Kentucky or KY 120 United is silencing voices, unquote. And Black Lives Matter actually called for more sick outs.
So now we have the union, and then we now have two other groups,
I guess,
right?
We have the union, we have the original, like, wildcat group is what one person called it, and I like that group because I like wildcats, right? So
mm-hmm.
we have the one wildcat group, and then we have, like, the second wildcat group that broke away from the first one. So, Jasmine, in my mind, in my eyes, the theme of this year when it comes to teachers is distrust. So there's obviously some significant distrust with the legislature, which is earned because of the way that the legislators
last year.
Yeah. And then there, of course, there's distrust with the union, and now there's even more distrust with like Kentucky 120 United. But, you know, one thing that I think we miss in the midst of this is that the teachers continue to rack up wins. The legislature has been completely unable to change their pensions. You know, they passed that bill, but it was overturned in the courts. And it does appear that many of the bills that were really concerning these people aren't going to pass.
Right.
So,
and they are racking up wins in the sense that they're winning a lot of these one-on-one battles. But in the grand scheme of things, they're really just keeping... They're managing the status quo. Like,
right.
Nothing is getting better for them.
Certainly.
I mentioned last week that other states that have seen teacher protesting have all gotten increased funding for mm-hmm. education in the end.
Except
and
for
Kentucky's the only state that hasn't. So
right.
even though the protests are helping and they're winning these one-on-one battles because these bills aren't getting passed, we're just maintaining right
that's,
now.
That's certainly the case, yeah. Yeah, we'll see what happens. The next budget will be after the gubernatorial election. So we will see if there are some changes made after the gubernatorial election to the budget, and especially how it relates to education. All right, Jasmine, tell us what we need to know about medical marijuana.
All right, so Representative Jason Nemes' medical marijuana bill passed the House Judiciary Committee 16-1 last Thursday. I think this was to a little bit of surprise, but it was after an emotional two-hour hearing. So it cleared the first big hurdle to passage, but that's only the first step. It would still have to pass the House and the Senate before heading to the governor's desk, and we're running out of time.
Right.
The bill's HB 136, and it has 44 sponsors, which is awesome. It has 35 Democratic sponsors and 9 Republican sponsors. The measure aims to turn medical marijuana into basically a completely Kentucky enterprise, from farms to the dispensaries. So the cannabis would actually be grown and it would be processed here. But it's a no-smoke bill, and I think this was kind of the compromise to get other people on board. So you would be able to consume it in the form of pills or oils, and it lists a number of conditions that would be eligible for prescribing it, including chronic pain, nausea, epilepsy, and some other illnesses. But it was a really emotional hearing because a lot of people testified. Some people testified that they've been using medical marijuana, that
nice.
They've been using marijuana to deal with chronic pain, talking about how they're viewed as a criminal when really they're just trying to treat their pain. And others testified about simply wanting the option. One woman brought her bag of medications that she takes every day. And I think that was really powerful as well. But the bill has a lot of regulations, such as prohibiting use or possession in certain places. It also allows employers to restrict use at work. It has an identification card program. So this is a heavily regulated bill. So it doesn't go super far,
right.
But it's a really good step.
It opens the door.
Right, absolutely. There's also been an amendment filed that would create an online reporting system for written certifications that doctors would be required to use. This is all well and good, but we're quickly running out of days, so it doesn't look like it's going to make it through this time. Many Democrats have actually criticized the bill because it doesn't go far enough and doesn't do anything to decriminalize marijuana, and I certainly agree with these folks, but I'll also take what I can get with a Republican supermajority legislature.
Right.
If this does pass, though, I think so much credit goes to Jason Nemes. He's a Republican who was against it in the past. He listened to people, he read the research, and he's done a lot of the heavy lifting to get the votes for this. And so while it doesn't look like it's going to happen this year, I think we're getting a lot closer. This didn't get a vote in committee last year. I think he kind of stopped it from getting a vote last year. And so I feel like we're getting closer. This was a pretty historic vote, and so maybe next year.
Yeah. Well, you know, we did get closer to having it pass in the House, I think is another one thing to say about it, which that's huge. But then after that, we have the Senate, which
a more conservative Senate.
Yeah, even more difficult lift. So, this is certainly progress. This is the first vote ever taken on medical marijuana. It has like almost half of the entire chamber sponsoring the bill. The fact that it can't get a floor vote with half the chamber supporting it is just absolutely insane to me. But what are you going to do, I guess? All right. Well, thanks, Jasmine. That is some good information about medical marijuana. Jasmine, I wanted to talk for a second about Passport. I was actually going to do this last week, so there hasn't been too much like brand new news around this story. But you may have heard that there has been a bit of a saga involving the Medicaid MCO, the Medicaid Care Organization, Passport, which is headquartered in Louisville. But I wanted to go a little bit in depth about this about Passport and why this has been in the news so much. Okay, so before we start, I wanted to give some important context in this. So Kentucky actually operates its Medicaid program a little differently than other states. So all the way back in 1995, Kentucky obtained an 1115 waiver. We've talked about those a lot, the ways that you can kind of operate entitlement programs to make them operate better. Kentucky obtained one of those 1115 waivers to have Medicaid provided by what are called managed care organizations. That's what I meant. Medicaid managed care organizations. That's what Passport is. So the state actually split into 8 regions and attempted to develop partnerships with organizations in each region. And they were supposed to be like these nonprofit organizations with you know, skin in the game that around the healthcare system in these 8 regions across the state. And ultimately, only 2 regions actually successfully developed partnerships. And those were the regions that included Louisville and the region that included Lexington. And the Lexington partnership actually didn't even last very long. The partner in Louisville, the only successful partnership, was Passport. Passport was formed out of several existing healthcare entities in Louisville, but the risk for the plan was borne by the University of Louisville Hospital. So the vision, I think, for the 1115 waiver back in the 90s for these partnerships, it was for them mostly to be nonprofit organizations or for the missions of the MCOs to be community-focused. But that didn't really work anywhere besides Louisville. Everything that happened after these partnerships kind of fell through, none of that was focused on the nonprofit sphere after that. So in 2011, the program changed in a big way. So before, the vision was for each region to have a single MCO providing Medicaid, and after 2011, Medicaid beneficiaries could choose any MCO as their provider if they're eligible to receive Medicaid. So if you were in Louisville, you could only get Medicaid from the MCO that cared for Louisville. If you were in Western Kentucky, you could only get Medicaid from the MCO that managed Western Kentucky. And after 2011, it was like any one of these MCOs, you can opt to get any of these.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of how the program operates now. There are 4 and 5, if you count it differently, there are 4 or 5 MCOs that are actually serving the state. WellCare, Humana Care Source, Aetna, and Aetna Care Source, and Passport. So those are the 4. Aetna or Aetna Care Source would be the one. You can either count that as 1 or 2. And of that group, only Passport is a nonprofit. So Humana, of course, is a for-profit. WellCare is a for-profit. All these other groups are for-profit organizations.
And I never really knew anything about Passport until I moved to Louisville, because when I became a criminal defense attorney, you were always dealing with wanting to get clients in treatment, and everybody had Passport. And yeah, that wasn't really a thing I knew about when I lived in Lexington.
Yeah, I think you definitely moved to Louisville after the Medicaid expansion,
right? Mm-hmm.
As well.
And I actually benefited from this. I was, you know, unemployed and in law school when the expansion went into effect. And so I had Humana Care Source for a time.
Yeah, so like you mentioned, Passport is very, very strong in Louisville, and that's mostly just because of the history. It
mm-hmm.
was the only option for people in Louisville up until 2011, and they have very strong brand awareness here in the city of Louisville, and not a lot outside of Louisville. So another bit of context around all of this: the way that MCOs operate is mostly fee-for-service, and this is true of all healthcare in most of the United States. The state sets a payment rate for a medical procedure, and it pays the MCOs based on what the procedures are performed for Medicare beneficiaries. So if a beneficiary gets a knee surgery, the state pays the MCO money for that patient to have a knee surgery. In turn, the MCOs pay the actual provider of the service based on a contract negotiated between the MCO and the provider. So that's the way that the system is supposed to work. Like, the state pays the MCO, the MCO pays the provider, and there's some money left over for overhead from Passport that the state doesn't have to operate with. And, you know, of course, since Passport's a nonprofit, it's not supposed to have any profit in there, and it's supposed to just flow right through. So the MCO of Passport is just taking on the overhead portion that the state no longer has to manage. The MCOs are essentially, you know, middlemen. That's one way to think about it. But in many cases, it's actually been shown that the MCO system actually results in lower overall costs than if the state did this work directly. So if the state was the one providing the overhead, it has been shown that that actually costs more overall because of expertise or whatever. I'm not sure why. You should read the papers if you want to.
read the papers.
Right. So as part of the regional plan, fee-for-service rates differ between all eight regions. So Kentucky basically said, okay, Western Kentucky, this is your fee schedule. Louisville, this is your fee schedule. Lexington, this is your fee schedule. And there are eight different fee schedules, eight different prices that the state paid for different medical procedures that occurred. They consolidated the state into two regions, essentially. So essentially like the Louisville area and the not Louisville area is how these regions were consolidated. And that actually happened very recently. So the rates for the not Louisville area, after they did this, which again was just like a year ago, the rates when they consolidated these fee schedules in the not Louisville area, on average, of course, they were averaging seven different regions. On average, it was a 0.8% increase in total fee schedules or in total fees. And then the rates in the Louisville area were actually cut by 4.1%. So you had eight regions. They moved it to two. They changed the fee schedules totally. They increased fees for places that were not Louisville by about 1%. And in Louisville, last year, they cut fees by about 4.1%. So Passport was set up to be a Medicaid provider, and nearly all of its income comes from Medicaid. So further, since Passport's roots are in Louisville, the cut of 4.1% to the Louisville area represents a massive cut for them. The effects of this cut will be felt much more severely by Passport than any of the other MCOs. So even though like all of the other MCOs actually operate in Louisville, Passport has the biggest market mm-hmm. share. And that means that they're having some serious, serious revenue issues. So after that, it's understandable that Passport is upset about everything that's happening. They feel singled out and that this cut is large enough to put their entire company in jeopardy. Passport appealed the rate changes back in January, and on January 15th, they went public about threats to their company due to the rate changes, and the state said that they would enter discussions to try to resolve the situation. So for their part, the state says that they depended on guidance from CMS, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services that the federal government has. The state depended on guidance from CMS to set the rates for the whole state, and they never intended to single out Passport. And according to Adam Meyer, the Secretary for Health and Family Services, CMS actually asked Kentucky to make the rates less complex. Again, we had that eight sections, eight groups with eight different fee schedules, and CMS was like, you got to fix this. And that even if the region consolidation hadn't happened, the Louisville region would have seen its rates reduced. That's what Adam Meyer had to say. So by mid-February, discussions between the state and Passport clearly had broken down because Passport filed a lawsuit, and that lawsuit was assigned to Judge Wingate in Franklin Circuit Court. The state acted surprised because they thought the negotiation process was ongoing, but Passport claimed that the state was ignoring all evidence that they brought to the table. The state said that Passport was, quote, unable to identify any legitimate issues with the soundness of our rates, unquote. Legitimately low is, of course, in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Passport's also seeking an injunction, which would return their old payment rates while the lawsuit is ongoing. And that's that hearing happened. It happened last week. I don't know what happened because I've been kind of out of pocket. Passport has said that under the new plan, it expects to lose about $144 million in 2019. Well, that's a lot
that's
of money.
That's a considerable
that's
amount.
Quite a bit of money. And it has already begun slashing expenses and restructuring their payment deals. And another complexifier in this situation is that it's planned a West Louisville headquarters, which would not be possible with these current rates. So on March 4th, Congressman John Yarmuth held a kind of like a rally of sorts in support of Passport, which was attended by the mayor, Mayor Fisher, and Councilwoman Barbara Sexton Smith. She represents the area where Passport's planned headquarters would go. And the meeting was actually crashed by Adam Meyer.
Meeting crashers?
Yes, meeting crashers. Adam Meyer and Scott Brinkman, meeting crashers. So Meyer and Brinkman are both members of the Bevin administration, and they basically like picked a fight with the congressman about Passport.
Awkward.
Yeah, it was very awkward. At one point, Meyer seemed to blame Judge Bozeman's overturning of the Medicaid expansion waiver for the cuts to Passport, and to me, that seems a little misguided.
Isn't that Boesberg?
You look it up. Make sure I'm right.
Okay.
At the end of the meeting, Congressman Yarmuth said that the state's actuaries should open their books and show the math of how they calculated the rates. We will actually see if that happens. Matt Bevin then held an impromptu press conference on Tuesday where he said, and that was last Tuesday, where he told reporters that Passport was, quote, a very poorly run operation from a financial standpoint, unquote, and that the event on Monday was, quote, political theater, unquote, because neither John Yarmuth nor Greg Fisher had ever reached out to his staff about the issue. He finished by saying that his administration was focused on the health of 315,000 Kentuckians and not, quote, bricks and mortar. So there you go. That's Matt Bevin's side of the story. saying that this was all a big stunt and that Yarmuth and Fisher should reach out to him. I don't know if he's necessarily a, you know, reliable actor about these kinds of things all the time, though.
Yeah, bringing people to the table hasn't really been a thing in the Bevan administration, has
right.
it?
No, absolutely not. So, Jasmine, at the end of the day, I think this is another case of poorly managed change to important systems in the Commonwealth under Republican rule. I'm sympathetic to the situation around Kentucky's Medicaid rates. It doesn't make sense to have 8 sets of rates if the MCO experiment failed. That was a cool idea. It didn't work out. So we got to, you know, bring stuff back to kind of the way that things used to be. But changing the rates in such a way that a single MCO has to bear such a brunt of the cuts definitely makes it seem like the state has it out for Passport. And with better leadership, I think that Passport and the other MCOs could have been better prepared for the changes, even though I'm not sold that cuts to rates were even necessary. And I think that Passport has been really great for Louisville. Everyone I know on Medicaid uses Passport because I live in Louisville. And generally, people are very pleased with the program.
Right. And I don't think this is true for some of these other providers that came about in 2011. But Passport, everyone always seems to like it, feels like they have really good coverage.
Yeah.
A headquarters would have been really good for West Louisville.
I mean, I think that the healthcare system is basically broken and nobody's all that pleased with their health insurance provider, even Passport. You know, they're working inside of a broken system. But for what they
right.
do, they
for
do
what
a,
the, yeah.
Yeah, they do a pretty good job. I also know several people who work for Passport and think the company is a good place to earn a living. I really, really hope that a path forward can be found because I really do value Passport. I think they're a very important part of the Louisville community, and I would be really, really sad to see them go. I hope that Passport can continue to exist and make a quick return to being a thriving part of our community.
It's right. Judge Boasberg.
Oh, man, I'm going to leave all that in there with you correcting me at the end. It's Judge Boasberg.
I was right.
Jasmine, give us the quick hits.
All right.
And these are kind of old, some of them. So they're like maybe a week old. So they're maybe a little out of date, but we need to tell you all about them.
Right. I didn't do quick hits last week. I should have, Robert. I'm sorry. After flying through the Senate, Damon Thayer's bill to strip the Secretary of State from their leadership of the Board of Elections failed in House committee. So in the, this is a long committee name, in the House Elections, Constitutional Amendments, and Intergovernmental Affairs Committee meeting on Monday, all 5 Democrats plus Jeff Hoover and Scott Lewis voted against the bill, meaning the vote ended 7-7 and did not receive a favorable report. The deciding factor seemed to be the testimony of Mary Sue Helm, an assistant Secretary of State who's worked with Secretary of States from both parties. Senator Thayer got really mad afterwards. He said, "This bill is not about Mary Sue Helm. This is about Allison Lettergan Grimes and the fact that she's under 3 investigations. For those of you who voted no, it's now on your hands that the integrity of voter rolls of this Commonwealth are in question as we head into a major gubernatorial primary."
I think he's going to blame Jeff Hoover if, you know, anybody besides Matt Bevin wins the election.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. And then I think someone said, we're not going to do this here. At the end,
yes.
After he said that.
It was Kevin Bratcher said that, which is kind of funny. Like, you know, kind of an ally sometimes.
All right. So next up, the bill allowing concealed carry without a permit passed the full legislature last Friday on a 60-37 vote. Several legislators crossed party lines, and this one kind of ended up being much more urban versus rural than Republican versus Democrat. LMPD and the Kentucky State Fraternal Order of Police were both opposed to this bill, but Matt Bevin has indicated that he would sign it.
He did sign it.
Yeah, so there that's law. Yeah. HB 268, the bill which sought to borrow $25 million and spend $75 million in rainy day funds, has been significantly pared down in the Senate. So the bill now only allows Kentucky State University to spend $290,000 to match a federal grant. However, now the bill will head to a conference committee, and who knows what's going to come.
Yeah, basically anything inside the House bill could become part of the conference bill. So there'll be negotiations between the House and Senate
right.
people as to what's going to happen there.
All right. SB 167. This is an uncontroversial bill that renames a bunch of stuff, and it does a small reorganization in some state health agencies. It passed the Senate unanimously, 35-0. In the House, however, Representative Kim Moser put forth an amendment that says, add that nothing in state law requires the secretary to pursue available federal funds. So it's thought that this change might be a backdoor way to end the Medicaid expansion.
Right.
Senator Julie Rocky Adams, who sponsored the original bill, asked that the amendment be removed from her bill, and Representative Moser agreed to do so, saying that she also didn't like surprises.
Which is kind of funny to me that she's like, oh, I don't like surprises either, when she's the one that sponsored the House floor.
Right. It was kind of strange. And there was this huge KFTC and Kentucky health advocates. Everybody like freaked out at once. And they worked with Representative Moser and she withdrew it. But it was kind of a weird statement that she made about it.
Well, that's funny to me. So like when we had the weird special session at the end of last year, you know, you had these two bills that were filed that were like, who wrote these? And Jerry Miller was like, I didn't, but I filed them. Maybe people should just like quit taking stuff that Matt Bevin is like, hey, do this. Yeah, just stop doing that.
All right. And last but not least, it's not looking good for the sports betting bill, HB 175. It passed unanimously out of its House committee, but its sponsor, Adam Koenig, said it's likely dead for now. So I think that's something people thought we would accomplish this year after, you know, the Supreme Court legalized it, but it doesn't look like that's going to happen.
Yeah.
It
doesn't look like we're going to get much done this session. Like a bunch of really crappy abortion bills, maybe the school safety bill.
Right. Concealed carry. Yeah. Universal.
Yeah, universal concealed carry and basically no medical marijuana, no sports betting.
No money bail.
Yeah, yeah. Like all the good stuff is not going to happen. So maybe next time. All right, let's listen to our interview with Amy Bensonhaver.
Amy Bensonhaver is a former assistant attorney general with the Kentucky Attorney General's Office and one of Kentucky's leading experts on open records requests. She spent 25 years working specifically on open records and open meetings requests at the Attorney General's office and now writes about those laws from the outside as a member of the public. She currently blogs at the Open Government blog at UK Scripps Howard First Amendment Center. And not many people in the state know quite as much about open records as she does, so we're really glad to have her on our show today. So Amy Bensonhaver, welcome to My Old Kentucky Podcast.
Thanks very much.
So you're here on March 13th because we are actually right in the middle of Sunshine Week. So tell us a little bit about Sunshine Week for people who might not know what it is.
It's essentially a nationwide celebration of open government laws. It started in 2005. I think the group that started it was the American Society of News Editors. And it coincides with the birth week of James Madison, who is sort of considered the philosophical founding father of open government laws.
Yeah, well, wow. So you've spent, I mean, we're asking you to come during Sunshine Week because you know so much about this, but you actually spent most of your career working in and around the open records and open meetings laws. And, you know, I think basically every public servant says they support more transparency in government, especially when they're running for office. Few are actually able to follow up once they, you know, gain power. Tell us why you think transparency is important and why so many people have trouble following up on their promises to run an open government.
I think it's sort of really succinctly stated in the Statement of Legislative Intent, which is basically free and open examination of public records is in the public interest, and the law has to be strictly construed and even if it causes inconvenience or embarrassment to public officials or others. I think the bottom line is it's easy to ascribe to the philosophy of free and open examination of public records is in the public interest, but when it comes to scrutiny of their own activities and their embarrassing circumstances, I think that's where they develop a level of discomfort. And literally, you can go through every administration, every prominent elected official, and identify some major controversy associated with them that's been exposed through the open records law.
So Kentucky passed its current version of an open records law back in 1992. And since then, the law has been the subject of dozens of court cases, and the legislature has made attempts to change the laws in several general assemblies. Tell us some of the ways, good and bad, that you've seen the law change over the years.
Okay, the revisions to the open records law that took back took place back in the early 90s, essentially those were pretty static. We didn't see much change at all in the law for many, many years. And we had a fairly evolving body of case law that was really supportive of this idea of open government. So we had a really simple, user-friendly law that was regularly employed by the media, by public citizens just interested in scrutinizing their public affairs. So there was really very little change in the law, even though there was argument that there was need for change into this century, because the bottom line is that the language of the statute's pretty dated. But it wasn't until recently that we saw these efforts to expand the secrecy in the law. I mean, there was a firm commitment to transparency in the law that was enshrined in the law from its, you know, from its inception. It's only recently that we've seen this sort of departure from that.
So how recently are you talking that this might have happened?
Really within the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we had 12 exemptions. That's what we were construing in the Attorney General's office, two exceptions to the general principle that every record is an open record. So we had 12 exceptions. Suddenly we're up to 14. We have exceptions being introduced in this session. At least four were being considered, and they were not really based on the public's interest so much as they were on the public's agency's interest in conducting business in secret.
Right.
Yeah.
And you mentioned, you know, you have these very specific things that you are in statute as open records. But of course, you know, you'll have rulings that do get argued, and people will always say this should be secret because of this reason or that reason. And those things kind of come out in case law. In what ways have you seen, like maybe between 1992 and a couple years ago and really the law was starting to change, like some of the, you know, case law that's kind of changed the way that you might want it to be construed? How has that changed over time?
I feel really comfortable with the way the courts have guided us in construing the law. Again, I think they are firmly committed to transparency. Where we have seen the need for changes in the law, it's typically been in cases like shortly after the events of 9/11, mm-hmm. which, you know, it's for a lot of people, it's still kind of an immediate scar. You know, there was a recognized need that we didn't have anything in Kentucky to really address records that might relate to critical infrastructure. Uh-huh. So in a period of time extending over 4 years, the legislature considered carefully, thoughtfully, bringing all the stakeholders to the table, mm-hmm. whether we needed a Homeland Security exemption, and in 2005 we got one.
Right.
But we don't, what we're seeing now is kind of this kind of cobbled together piecemeal kind of like, well, I'm concerned about economic development, I'm concerned about personal privacy, I'm going to change the law.
Right.
And the stakeholders are not brought to the table. There's no careful contemplation or consideration. And it's kind of frightening.
Right. That's certainly the case. So, you know, you mentioned that there, you know, it's just been a couple years ago that people really started trying to change the law. But, you know, like you mentioned, the statute's pretty old now. It goes back to 1992. So, I mean, are there any changes to the law that you think are necessary that could maybe modernize or change the way that the law is written that might make it better?
I can tell you that whenever I have suggested that there's a need for modernization, there's a pushback because there is this really serious concern, and now I see why, that legislators will be inclined to dilute the law. You know, we have a fairly strong law in Kentucky. In this session, one of the positive things that's come about is, you know, many years after email became a common way of transmitting information, we now have a bill that recognizes that email transmission of an open records request is permissible. But that was not established in the law until this session. So we're not utilizing technology to really enhance the public's rights of access. We're using dated language in our statute. 1994 was when we got this language that related to formatting of electronic records, and it's, you know, it's framed in terms of ASCII format. I mean, there's so much dated language in the statute, but again, there's that resistance to the even idea of change because we don't want to see anybody dilute the law.
We've got the email bill, but it looks like it may be doubtful that any other changes to the open records law are going to pass this session. There were some major changes kind of floated around by GOP representative from Hopkinsville, Jason Petrie, this year. Tell us a little bit about these bills and why you do or don't like them.
Well, I don't like them.
Okay. I didn't think so.
Yeah, but I mean, basically, there was also a bill proposed by Danny Carroll, Senator Danny Carroll, and he's Paducah. I think Petrie, I believe, is from, like, it's Elkton, whatever that is. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm not trying to be disrespectful, but the reality is that I think what they reflected was that neither of them really understood the fundamental principles that inform the law, because both of them, again, were trying to do these carve-outs that were aimed at select groups and select people that's interest were being served. And the beauty of our law, and the thing I always felt really passionate about, was the idea that everyone stands in the same shoes. Everyone has equal rights of access to the law. It doesn't matter to records. It doesn't matter why they're asking, who they are. They have the same rights of access. But both Petrie and Senator Carroll essentially tried to introduce provisions into the law that would create this process of selective disclosure. We're only going to let residents use our law now. Now, that's a really, really retrogressive approach to the law. So this idea of just residents being able to use law, that would be...
Right, that makes things really difficult for maybe like journalists that are out of state and things like that.
Researchers, student journalists. Yeah. I mean, there's all... And there are people who simply need records from this state who would be foreclosed. And it is by far the minority of states that do that. So we're going back in time rather than forward. The other thing I think that their bills reflected was that they didn't understand that there are adequate protections in the law for the things they're targeting. Personal privacy of public employees who are at a greater risk, adequately protected in law. In Petrie's case, economic development records, where they need to be protected, they are adequately protected. So what he was essentially trying to do was create greater secrecy for governmental entities, like, again, the Amazon deal, the incentive mm-hmm. package. That had nothing to do with the private corporation's records. Those were the city's records. We don't need to protect public agency records. If we're going to protect records for economic development purposes, we want to encourage outside entities to do business with the state by giving them a certain amount of protection for confidential or proprietary information, not public agencies.
Right. And I was going to ask you about Danny Carroll's bill as well that contained a penalty provision for records custodian. Talk to us a little bit about that and why that's bad for open records.
The reason that creates a huge problem is because records custodians already have a thankless job. They are in a high-pressure job. They are underpaid. They are probably the most recent hire. And essentially what you're being asked to do is, and this was personal liability. This was not a penalty for, you know, the agency. This was personal liability, up to $500 for disclosure of records that Senator Carroll deemed to be protected. And again, they are protected records under the existing law, but he was basically, if those records somehow, a social security number wasn't redacted, that custodian could be, you know, levied fines of up to $500, and that disincentivizes that public of that custodian of records to make those records available. Their inclination is going to be, I'm not going to give anything out. I don't want to take a chance on getting nailed with a penalty.
Right.
So it's so counter open government that it really represented a serious threat. It also is significant that the penalties for willfully withholding unprotected information are up to $25 a day. Those are slap on the wrist kind of penalties. Those mm-hmm. are not the kind of serious penalties for people, $500 penalties. So,
right.
Yeah.
Okay, so throughout the years, you've actually worked with lots of different people who've worked to add transparency to our system. You know, your career spans back, you know, I think we mentioned at the beginning, like 25 years working on open records and open meetings requests. So I'm interested to know, like, can you name some people who throughout the years have been champions from open records and open meetings?
Yeah, I think, in my opinion, obviously, the people who have advocated in the courts, John Flyshaker and some of his colleagues, Jeremy Rogers, a young man named Michael Abadi, who is now kind of working in this area very effectively. So clearly those are the people who are building the law, but there are people who, the private citizens, I think that's what always gets overlooked, is that you've got private citizens with limited resources who are out there really putting their necks out to try to expose governmental corruption. And there's a certain level of retaliation that they face that a big, you know, you're not faced with if you're the Courier Journal or the Herald Leader,
right.
You know. So I think they're my heroes. And there are a few legislators who I think have aggressively advocated for greater transparency. Jim Wayne in 2017 refused to attend a closed meeting of the full House of Representatives on pension matters. He just said, this is an open meeting, I'm walking out. Mm-hmm. So I think there are a few legislators. Chris Harris from Pike County is a great guy. There's some who have really, really pushed for greater transparency.
I do think it's really funny whenever we ask, like, who's a good example
Jim
of a
Wayne.
Good legislator? Everybody's Jim Wayne. Yeah,
he is.
Absolutely.
He is.
All right, so before we let you go, I do wonder if people are interested in the idea of open records or open meetings, are there ways that people can get informed about ways they might be able to file their own open records requests or ways that they might be able to start being some of these citizen heroes that you're talking about?
Well, here's the really amazing coincidence, is that I started speaking in the course of all of this chaos that we've experienced in this session. I reached out to a woman who's a former editor I'm plugging this here, guys. she's a former editor of the Kentucky New Era, a great newspaper in Western Kentucky. And she and I are really very serious about forming a citizen-based coalition. Most states have a citizen-based coalition to provide advocacy and support and education for citizens. The Kentucky Press Association does an excellent job of advocating for the media's interest. Mm-hmm. And by and large, those dovetail with the public's interest. But Jennifer Brown and I believe that there is a need in Kentucky for a citizen-based advocacy group that can work with citizens to advance the causes of open government. And I hope you don't mind, but I am going to share our email addresses.
Please do. Yeah, mind? Go right ahead.
Yeah, because my email address is very weird, but I don't have an official email address. Mine is misbehavior. It's MissBehaver at gmail.com.
I don't know why you think that's weird. I think that makes perfect sense. It's your name.
It's exactly right.
It's your name. That's all it is.
And Jennifer's is, because I don't want to get this wrong, JennPBrown. So Jen P. Brown at yahoo.com. So what we're really hoping to do is bring together people from across every, you know, walk of life and every polarity on the political spectrum. We want to bring together people that really all support the idea of open government so that there is an additional voice. And I give all credit to the Kentucky Press Association, but they do represent a constituency. And
right.
There are citizens across Kentucky who are really, really looking for just support and understanding and just a sense of what it is they're going to be looking at when they undertake an open records appeal.
Well, it's very exciting to hear that that's coming.
I know.
Yeah, so we're great. That's great to hear. And thank you for coming to visit us here during
Absolutely.
Sunshine Week.
Yes.
All right, Jasmine, how can people get a hold of us?
They can find us on Twitter or Instagram at MyOldKYPod. They can like our Facebook page. They can listen to the podcast on the podcasting app of your choice, now including Spotify. We send out a weekly newsletter on Fridays that will be back this week. You can subscribe to that at forwardky.com/email. And finally, we have a Patreon. You can support our creation and what we do each week for as little as $1 a month at patreon.com/myoldkentuckypodcast.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.